Hey guys, if you want updates on our latest episodes, then be sure to subscribe to the Film Colossus podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, if you'd like to support the show and hear episodes ad-free, then subscribe to our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmcolossus.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
My name is Chris Lambert.
And my name is Travis Bean. And on today's episode, we discuss Damien Chazelle's adored musical, La La Land. If you love this movie, then be prepared, because neither Chris nor I really care for it. We discuss all the elements of what we perceive to be a very flawed movie with an unrealized ending. So sorry. Also, be warned, there are spoilers for the movie Mulholland Drive in this episode.
La La Land. La La Land. La La Land. This is a movie that excites so many people. Like, there are people that have clicked on this episode hopeful and positive and looking forward to a delightful discussion about a movie that they cherish.
Yeah. Or if they hate us, like if they don't particularly like Chris and I, then they're in for a treat, because you're not going to like us, especially after this.
But if they did like us, we're just tanking all of that goodwill.
I know. I mean, we're covering La La Land because it's an article that does really well on our site and people really love it. But in the back of my head, I almost wanted to push that we didn't do this episode, because I mean, there's plenty going on. Like, we've written about it, and you know, there's plenty to analyze in the movie, and I can see why it hits home for people. But for me, anyway, I don't know if Chris's thoughts have changed at all. But for me, like, this movie, I've never liked it. I've seen it a couple times now. It's never hit home with me, and I kind of only have complaints about it. So, like, if you like this movie, I'm really sorry, but you're just gonna hear me complaining for the next probably hour or so.
Which, I mean, happens. We can't like everything that everybody likes.
I mostly like movies that nobody else likes, so I get it.
Yeah. And then this is right up your alley in terms of, like, just a cherished positive movie for so many people, and you're like, I hate.
I like plenty of positive movies, by the way. Popular positive movies. You know, I'm usually, honestly, that energy usually wins me over. I'm usually a sucker for that kind of thing, and I tend to not like grim, sad movies. Usually this kind of thing, I'm like, I like it. Like, there's nothing offensive about it. Except in this case, I find a lot of offense.
Okay. So let's
let's get into it.
Jump back to when this came out. Yeah, 2016. Did you see it in theaters?
Was this a theater movie for you? I was very excited about it. I think at the time I had seen Whiplash already, and I remember liking Whiplash, wasn't crazy about it. But now, you know, La La Land, I love Ryan Gosling, love Emma Stone. It's a musical. I love musicals. Looks colorful, looks vibrant. I'm in.
Yeah, musicals are fantastic. And then, of course, Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling are two of the most charming people. Yeah, watchable, charming people. Oh my God, why am I blanking on the other movie she was in with him?
Crazy Stupid Love.
Yes, Crazy Stupid Love.
And Gangster Squad.
Yeah, Gangster Squad, I don't care about, but...
Well, no, but I would purely see that movie for them.
Crazy Stupid Love, I remember liking...
Oh yeah, but it's a good movie.
Not being, like, knocked over by.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't know if the movie's really trying to knock you over.
No, but I thought it might be a little funnier than what it was.
Mm.
But still decent.
Decent.
Okay, so you saw this in theater, and how were you feeling while sitting in the movie theater?
Okay, so here's how I'll preface this whole thing. Since I have seen this movie, this has happened in the last few months. I have rewatched both Whiplash and La La Land, and I have found out something deeply true about myself, is that I do not like Damien Chazelle as a director. Nothing against the guy. He seems cool. Youngest person to ever win a Best Director Oscar. Like, that's badass. He didn't have, like, you know, he didn't have, like, parents in the industry that help him get a job. Like, he purely, like, pulled himself up by the bootstraps and, like, made a career, and, like, that's badass. But his style, we'll get into the nuances of it, but I've never connected with it. And my recent rewatch of Whiplash, like, now I don't really like that movie. And I think the opening two dance numbers of La La Land exemplify what I really don't like about him. And that is the first thing I think of when I think about watching the movie the first time in theaters. I remember, honestly, the feeling I had watching those first two scenes was like embarrassment. Oh. Which is a really mean, shitty thing to say. But like, I almost, like, I felt bad for like bringing Lauren to the movie. Like, because I was definitely the one that wanted to go see it. Like, I felt a little embarrassed. I was like, oh my God, like, what is this? And it just, like, it felt like the dance numbers, they felt forced. They felt like they were trying to be playful, but weren't. The dancing felt like awkward to me. Like, it didn't feel like any of the musicals that it is ostensibly portraying. You know, like, it feels like it's trying to be like a Singing in the Rain or something like that. Mm-hmm. And like, just while I'm watching, I'm like, it's hard for me to put into words why I'm not connecting with these movies, because I guess, you know, I don't direct movies, and I guess my vocabulary in that arena isn't especially well versed. But like, however it's being choreographed and maneuvered, like, I'm just not connecting with the whatever energy it's purporting. So that's my main memory, is that, like, I remember the first two scenes, I was like, oh my God, like, what is this? And like, this is I can't believe I have to sit here and like watch an entire movie of this. And then I think the rest of the movie was better. Like, I didn't end up hating it as much as I thought I was going to after those first two scenes. But that is kind of the my main memory of the movie, is like, I thought it was going to be one thing, and I was like, oh wait, like, I'm not into this at all.
And then when it ended, did you look over and Lauren's just crying, like, I loved it? Or was she also?
I think we were both on the same page. Like, we liked it, but weren't blown away by it, you know?
Okay.
Like, I don't even know if I'd go as far to say that I liked it, but I wasn't offended by it or anything. The offense came later.
Okay.
The second time I watched it.
For me, I remember the hype around Whiplash when it was at Sundance, but I didn't catch it when it was there.
Mm.
But
was it there the year we were there?
It was there the year before. I had gone that first time in 2013.
Got it.
And I remember people talking about it, but I didn't know anything about it. I hadn't seen a trailer. And then when it came out later in the year, I was hooked. I thought it was such a cool movie. I was into everything Chazelle was doing. I was so excited for whatever he was going to do next. And then it was like La La Land.
La La Land would have been next.
I don't mind musicals, but there was something about just the trailers. Just, it wasn't necessarily what I was hoping to see from him next. So this was one that I missed when it was in theaters.
Mm-hmm.
Despite liking Emma Stone, like, I was early on the Easy A train. I remember seeing Easy A in theaters and being like, oh my goodness, like, the girl from Superbad is a star. That was so good. So I was like, I mean, Ryan Gosling too, I liked both of them, but for some reason there was just something holding me back. And then everybody loved the movie, and for some reason, I just never got into it. And then, I don't know why, but recently, maybe I was trying to go through the most popular movies on Letterboxd that I had it watched. and La La Land was up there, but I decided to finally watch it. And yeah, similar reaction. It's just immediately was not for me. And I got progressively more disinterested and annoyed as the movie progressed. Second viewing now, a little softening of the edge, but not to a point where I would say that I'm like a fan. In any way, shape, or form. There's still like narrative structuring, math. There's math. Anybody
there's
that's
plenty
listened
of math. I expect to get an algebra lesson in this episode.
Yeah, anybody that's listened to multiple episodes of the show knows that I, for some reason, have a penchant for making movies about math.
I love it. It's a different perspective.
And this is one where the math really frustrates me.
Actually, I'm excited to talk about the math because I think it might be the one area. Well, here's how I'll say it. I don't know if I necessarily disagree or agree with you, but I assume you're talking about the ending when you say math.
Yes. Yes.
And I also don't like the ending, but I like it for, I dislike it for different reasons.
Yeah. As I was watching it for this podcast, I was sitting there being like, Travis and I are going to agree, but for completely different reasons as we get into our points.
To be clear, whenever you watch a movie, you imagine me sitting right next to you. So you say we watched it.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
That's how do it. So I get it.
It's beautiful. Yeah. You sit down next to Lauren on the couch and you're like, Lauren, could you move over just a little bit? Leave some room for Chris.
Could you pass him some popcorn?
Yeah. Just toss it. He's waiting for you to toss it into it. Just toss it. See if he can catch it.
I totally get you like thinking about the kind of movies you like Whiplash is a total Chris movie. And like Whiplash is gritty. It's like, it's a dark setting, you know, it's all indoors. It's all about like pushing yourself to achieve something, but in this very intimately gritty way, you know, like that is not what La La Land's doing at all. It's light, it's floating, it's colorful. It kind of has a more distance perspective about the plight of making it in Hollywood and being in La La Land, you know, you're like dreaming in the clouds and all that. It definitely has a completely different feel. So I could totally see you seeing the trailer to this and be like, nah, not for me.
Yeah, not quite. Like, okay, so let's just get in there. Let's start talking about it.
Yeah. I guess I'll say the thing that I really like about this movie, even though it comes with a slight detractor because I think it could have been better, but Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone are just like so good together.
Yeah.
That no matter what they're saying or doing, like it works. It's very watchable. That's probably the nicest thing I can say about this movie, even though I don't like it and I don't think it works and I don't want to watch it if I'm forced to watch it. Like it's watchable, I guess, because like I like these two people. Like I guess I could watch just footage of them like going to get coffee and talking. Like that would be the equivalent of watching this movie for me. But I just think they're such stars and they're so good together. And we talked about it on the Drive episode, how good Ryan Gosling is partnered up with another actor. He seems to kind of thrive off feeding off someone else's energy. And maybe he is a little lackluster actually when he's in a solo vehicle in a movie. Just watching these two together is a treat.
Yeah, I think that is 95% of what makes this movie work. Yeah. Is the fact that you have two of the most charismatic actors of their generation being as charismatic as they possibly can. It's like every scene is designed to make you love them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's effective. Like it worked on me. Like I cared about their relationship. I was excited to see them interact. Like all the scenes where they're just talking and doing things.
Yeah.
Completely interested in whatever they're saying and doing and watching them say and do it.
As you say that, you are reminding me that there's plenty of the movie where it's not them together talking. Like there's plenty of moments where they're off trying to do their own thing and there's plenty of introduction and there's plenty of like post relationship, you know?
Yeah. So. Which is the sore spot. But
yeah, math.
I it's so I was I think that carries so much of what the movie's doing. And then just because it's going for some bigger swings, I think that appeals to people. And I think even just stepping back, the movie is unique in its visual palette and the scenes that it's giving us, to where even if I think the context around them going to the observatory and like going into outer space and doing their dance number is incredibly cheesy to the point where it's not interesting to me, I understand why that appeals to somebody that's just swept away by the fact that that's a visual that they're getting to experience. So I see the appeal. Even that opening dance number you mentioned, I go back and forth on it, and this is something that I think we've argued about in the past. There's part of me that's impressed by the fact of the sheer, not quality, but the effort that it would take to put that scene together to where it's all one shot. The coordination that you have to have,
we have
the camera crew, like all the actors, the choreography, all of it, to be able to nail that in one take is always very impressive to me. I'm always a fan of long shots, one takes. And that's very true for that scene on a technical level. I really appreciate the technical aspects of it. But then, like with you, as I'm watching it, there's something that's just hitting me as incredibly cheesy and tryhard at the same time.
Chris, you are agreeing with me right now. We have had this discussion. It was an argument. And I said at the time, I can definitely appreciate something on a technical level, like the work and concentration and collaboration it takes to nail something like that. Like, that's badass. That has nothing to do with the end product. If it is, if it isn't giving off something like this scene, for instance, like it's trying to give off this ethereal feel, something whimsical, something that's introducing the city of Los Angeles. Like, if those were all the goals of this scene, like, I'm not feeling it. Like, I'm not pulled into this movie in the way it's trying to do.
Yeah, it's trying to get us into, like, these are the dreamers, right? It's a city full of talented people that have dreams, but they're stuck in their cars on the highway. And there's a metaphor there to the fact that, especially you see Seb and Mia in their cars waiting to go somewhere, waiting to do something. And you, that even comes back to at the end of the movie, they're able to, Mia and her husband, take, like, the off lane, right? She's successful enough that she can get out of the traffic and go do something else, and live her life in a different way rather than being one of the people in traffic waiting for her lane to open up. So I think you can definitely make an argument about the metaphor of the artist in the car on the highway. But then again, is the execution of it, or is that the best way to demonstrate that? Especially I think about it in terms of the Barbie movie. And I find the opening song of the Barbie movie very charming and well done and dynamic in a way that for some reason this just didn't land at all.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
I mean, the opening Barbie song, and by the way, I was thinking of Barbie as well. I was like, I know we're going to talk about Barbie in this episode. that song, it introduces, it's a well done, like the way it's choreographed, the way it moves, all the different characters it introduces, like it's doing so much, but at the same time, it is letting you know what the movie's about. It is laying out everything for you. It's giving you a little guide and saying like, here's what the movie's about. Like, here's everything you need to know. And it's not like, I mean, obviously it's not that simple. Like it's just laying the foundation for what will blossom and become the movie, become the structure of the movie. Being able to do that is not easy. And doing it in a technically fascinating way is not easy. That's my whole complaint about this movie. And it can really, everything I'm going to say can just come back to this. And in fact, end right here. You can turn off the episode right here if you want. I just don't think that like it's stylistically very interesting or well done. Like I'm not pulled in by any of this. And that is like, that's a very broad complaint. So, like if someone is really pulled in by La La Land's aesthetic, then like, I guess we just inherently disagree, but it's not hitting me at that base level. So like, I'm never able to be pulled in and dig into the crevices and explore the nuances of the movie. Cause like you talking about that scene where Mia goes on the off ramp and like the metaphors and this, and the symbolism going on in the movie, like I see all of that. I wrote the guide. Like I know that's all there. My problem with the movie is I never feel those things. You know, that's my problem with Whiplash as well. I only ostensibly read everything. I only know what the movie's trying to say and what it's purporting, but like I want to be enveloped by it. You know, I want to feel enraptured. I want to feel like there's no escape and that I'm exploring all of these themes and ideas with the characters. And La La Land, like, it just constantly feels like I'm watching something that's been awkwardly staged and constructed. Like, that whole opening scene to me is very awkwardly staged. And the choreograph is, like, like the people's smiles and the way they're acting. Like, it's like, we're doing this, you know? Like, it feels very stage musical to me. Where like you kind of need to do those things to pull people in, but it doesn't, to me, that doesn't work in a movie, you know, as I've seen in a lot of musicals, I've seen in The Rain, just going back to something like that, or even something as recent as Spielberg's West Side Story, like the feel of those movies are different. The way you're sucked into the movement and choreography is completely different. This movie just doesn't have it. So it's really hard for me to become part of this world of the characters.
It's funny because as you were starting to talk about Whiplash and not feeling it, like Whiplash for me, I do feel that envelopment. Like I get into Andrew's intensity in that, but there is a distance to the filmmaking.
Yes.
Like more of a third person omniscience that's not doing what we had talked about in earlier episodes about that embodiment of the character psyche. That's something that I think you really like, and that observational distance that's kind of there in Whiplash has a little more of that like distancing effect for you.
You're totally right about that. And I observed that while I was watching Whiplash, and I think it actually speaks to why Damien Chazelle's movies connect with so many people. I mean, Whiplash and La La Land, I think, are both in the top 25 most popular movies on Letterboxd. Like, people adore these movies. They really like Damien Chazelle. And I think part of his formula is that he has a little bit of a distance from his characters, and that he isn't so penetrating that you are you're forced to be like part of the journey with the character. There is an observational distance, and in that respect, you're able to apply your own life to what's going on. which I think is a key element of why he connects with people. I personally, I just keep trying to find ways of saying things without sounding too pretentious. That is like the opposite of what I want art to do, and is maybe the most boring way art can be, in my opinion. I want to become one with the character. I want to be part of their world. To me, that is like, that's why I have a big TV and surround sound. Like, I want to be enveloped. Like, I want to be in the shit with them. And I think he purposely doesn't really have that energy with his movies. Maybe he does with Babylon. I haven't seen it, but La La Land and Whiplash, it's not giving me what I need.
I'd be incredibly curious to hear your thoughts on Babylon, because
I almost watched it. The only reason, I was so close to watching it, like my finger was on the button, you know, ready to click play. The only reason I did it is the article's doing well on our site, and I think we may have to cover it at some point, and I couldn't bear the thought of watching a 3-hour movie twice.
Yeah. I mean, if you just watch it sooner, we can just cover it sooner. It's fascinating to me because I feel like it's relevant to the La La Land discussion, because La La Land to me feels like a throat clearing. He was actually working on Babylon already, if I read correctly as I was putting the movie guide together. He was, I think, working on it for a few years and putting it off to the side at times. And when he did First Man, he just was like, all right, I have to finish this and do it as the next movie. So I think La La Land was almost him doing a proof of concept in a way, or starting to get the framework of getting into the idea of the Hollywood dream.
Yeah.
And exploring some of the history of Hollywood, trying to fuse the past and the present by bringing that, what is it, anachronization? Is that the word? The idea of the musical that's such a historic part of film now rather than a present part.
Right.
And modernizing it and trying to have these characters do something old in this new time frame. And even Gosling's entire character, Seb, right, is kind of rooted in traditional stuff, old school stuff. His furniture at the end, when he's successful, he has like a Smegma fridge in his place. Like, it's a very classic vibe that he's portraying, while Emma Stone, Mia's just very kind of present and new. There's interesting dynamics and concepts that he's exploring through the characters, through the style. There's a fusion of style, but I just don't think he quite gets there in fully realizing what he's trying to say, because the film doesn't have enough time. And he ends up
math
cramming it in and really shortchanging the last act and the necessary exploration. Because this is the thing, okay, this is the main problem for me, is that the movie is so grounded in the dreams of these characters from the opening number and establishing the broader, this is a city full of dreamers, to then zeroing in on these two. And they're early in their careers, they're struggling, they're trying to figure it out. It's not enough to just have them make it and put a bow on it and say, you know what, she's a successful actor now, he has his club, it costs them something dear, but their lives are okay. What does that actually, the success that they were trying to achieve, what does that actually mean to them? And that's the part that the movie completely refuses to explore in any way. And in a movie where that was the main goal and the main desire was just to reach that point, to never have the characters reflect on it, talk about it. Is Emma Stone, like, is Mia happy? Is she satisfied with where she's at in life? Would she trade it all in? Maybe not, but was the career worth it? Has she done even that much? I know that she's now like an it girl. We see her picture on things, but really, how long was she filming? How long did it take the movie to release? It's been 5 years since she went off. So you can imagine it had to have been maybe 2 years until the movie came out. Has she really just done like two movies at this point and is a superstar? Is she excited? Does she have imposter syndrome? Has she settled in? Like, vindication? What about Seb? Like, is he fully satisfied at this point? Is he doing the kind of jazz? It seems like it. We get the implications and the hints that the characters are okay with where their life's at, but we spent so much time front-loading what this would mean to them and why they want it, to then not get anything about the reality of the situation and if it's everything they wanted, if it's not what they wanted. That's such a cop-out to me. It's cowardly. I think the story is actively cowardly in failing to explore that. But Babylon is 3 hours. And Babylon, he goes for it and dives into all of it. And I think it's a lot more satisfying and a lot more complete and just better on the whole than everything that La La Land says and does.
Here's my follow-up question to that, though. Babylon technically does all those things, answers all those questions you're asking about La La Land. But is it enjoyable to watch? And is it technically well done in a way that you're like, you feel a sense of completion and you enjoyed watching it?
Yeah, there were sequences in Babylon that I thought were truly... Is generational a right word that I could use here?
So you really like Babylon?
I didn't, but it's weird. Okay, so when I first saw There Will Be Blood, I watched it 3 hours. I looked over at my friend who asked me to go see it, and I said, I will never watch that movie again. And then I thought about it for 6 months. It came out on Blu-ray. I bought it immediately, and it became like a top five movie for me all time.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes I just have to sit with the movie. Tar was another one that I didn't like at first. And then on second watch and thinking about it, it's continued to stay with me and rise in my estimation. Babylon is another one where, to me, it was just like some issues more so in the third act. But that the first hour and a half of the movie was pretty brilliant. And then you have maybe an hour where it gets a bit rocky and a bit predictable and a bit cliche before the last like 10 to 15 minutes kind of bring it home again.
This guy sure likes cliches. I will say that.
Yeah. I think with La La Land, that was also just, it felt very kind of cliche to me.
It's a big part for me. You know, I think we talked about in the last episode, and again, this is a very pretentious thing for me to say, but when you've watched thousands of movies, like, it gets harder and harder to watch a movie like this that has so many tropes and cliches and is candid about it. Like, this movie, you know, they go to the planetarium where Rebel Without a Cause was filmed, and like, it definitely evokes the energy and themes of that movie, you know, being young and rebellious and finding yourself, you know, all that stuff. And it, just the way it's candidly feels like it's recalling, you know, the umbrellas of Cherbourg. I never noticed it. Cherbourg? I should look it up. Or just something like Scene in the Rain. Like, it definitely gives off that feel. It's just very difficult when you've seen as many musicals as someone like me has seen to, like, look at La La Land and be like, it's just not that impressive. I guess that's the meanest way I can put it.
I mean, yeah, there's something about, there's always, to me, I guess, something nice about having a reference, but then it's the question of, what did you do with it?
Totally.
Did you extend the reference? Did you add on to the reference? Like, going back to Barbie as an example, I feel like that movie has a ton of references being used. It's very much, almost in some ways, like a love letter to cinema as it is a critique of like politics and political structures and exploration of human condition and fear of death and all of that. So much going on, but just the way in which it references 2001 in the opening scene, but applies it to its own purpose and really makes it a new statement through the reference. The same thing with its reference to Fight Club at the end. It calls back to it while also making it meaningful within the story and themes. And I don't know, like the Rebel Without a Cause shout out, they even like show the scene from the movie, right? Mm. And then recreate it. And it's like, that's nice, but what,
scene to me exemplifies exactly what I don't really like about Chazelle's filmmaking. And not really fair, because I love Rebel Without a Cause. Like, I always kind of, that's a bit part of me whenever a movie is doing something like this with the movie I really love and doing it in a way that I don't like, that really irks me. And I absolutely love Rebel Without a Cause. It's one of the most beautiful, one of the prettiest movies I've ever seen. And, you know, going beyond pretty, like all the visuals in that movie, the complete aesthetic of it, the colors, the whole mood and feel, it's all in service of what the movie's exploring. And I feel like this movie couldn't be less aware of that. Like when you see them go into the planetarium, I think the movie needs to capture what Rebel Without a Cause did, but it doesn't even feel like it's trying to at all. Like it feels, as we've discussed, observational and distant. Like it's just recognizing that this movie existed and that this happened, and that's pretty much the extent of it. Like, and it's trying to create its own whim, its own whimsical air, and I'm not feeling it. Like, if I'm not feeling it, then like from the word go, if I'm not just feeling it on a base level, like I'm not being pulled into whatever it's doing. It's a strange mix of energies all happening there at the same time, where like it's referential, it's like trying to be floating and whimsical, it's like trying to do all these things at once, and I'm not even like catching any of the little bits and pieces a little bit. So as a whole, like I'm not even sure what it's trying really to say.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
It's just the same kind of commentary that you get from Mulholland Drive, right? That
I was going to bring up Mulholland Drive as well.
People go to Hollywood with a dream, and the realities of the situation can be soul-crushing. It's a little more of the negative, half glass empty in Mulholland Drive. This looks at essentially the cost of success by shaping that cost into the relationship that they could have had, which is still like strange, because in the flash of what their life could have been, the what if at the end, I mean, you could make the argument that it's just each of them thinking through what could have been, but also the argument that the movie's showing us what they gave up, what they sacrificed to go their paths. Yet in the alternative life, they would have both been successful anyway. Like, she would have still gotten the movie, and he still would have opened a club or been a musician in a way that appealed to him. All that needed to be different was him not take the job with Keith, and things would have been okay. He would have struggled for a little longer.
I agree. It kind of loses its impact because of that.
Yeah. So if the point that you're making is that they had a fork in the road and they both chose career and they got the career they wanted in other lives, but it was at the cost of maybe having not the careers they wanted, but each other, you kind of spoil that by saying like, oh, they could have had it all. which makes it a little more tragic in some ways. But also, what are we doing here?
Yeah, tragic in what way? If that really is the goal, and for it to serve as a tragedy, like, what was the foundation for that being the takeaway of the movie, for that being the movie's aesthetic, that, like, these things are tragic, and if you really want to make it a Hollywood, you have to give up something, like, sure and wonderful and cathartic. That's not really part of the movie. The movie, I guess this gets to what I really don't like about the movie, is I never really know what it's about. In the end, as you've said, it ends up being about sacrifice. And if that's what the whole movie would have been doing, if that would have been like the thrust of the movie, the ending probably would have hit a little more. Again, I think a big problem of the ending is on a technical level. I just don't think it's that interesting. The whole like one shot, like moving through everything, like it's a very cliche thing to do. And I just was kind of rolling my eyes at it the whole time. Rolling my eyes at the scene that everybody loves. But if that's really the goal, like I don't see how that's part of the movie's DNA throughout. Like obviously that comes in here and there, but like it's not the thrust. I think that's just the general, at least Whiplash like has direction. Like you know what that movie's doing. This is about a guy who is giving up everything in his life, pushing away everybody in his life constantly in service of something. And La La Land, like, the best parts are when the movie isn't really concerned about anything, when we're just watching Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling together. But any moment where it's trying to like define itself and purport anything thematically interesting, it just like, I mean, I'm sitting here thinking like, I don't really know what the movie's about. And I wrote a whole guide on it. I guess I know what it's about because I can think about all the different things people have said and like the ideas that came across. But like when I think about the movie as a whole, when I think about the aesthetic, I wouldn't necessarily say like it has a strong image or personality of like something specific, you know, that would make the ending hit in that way.
It's strange because we do start with that dance number that establishes the dreamers of Los Angeles. And then you have the song from Emma Stone that's about like, here's to the dreamers. So it kind of comes back to saying like all of you people, and this is the point of Babylon too, is that all of you people who are, well, Babylon's more specifically about making movies, like, but everybody that's making movies, all of you who struggle, who want to be part of this, like this is for you. And in honor of kind of the sacrifices that you're making and the dreams that you have. And it's like you have that broader conceit here for the city itself, not just for Hollywood, even though that's a big part of it, but for all the Sebs and the person on the bike that's going around at the opening number and the dancers and the singers and all of it, all the people that are there looking for their break. It's just the stories being codified in the journey of these two characters and the, in quotes, like ultimate sacrifice or the big sacrifice that it takes, kind of the ways in which you have to embarrass yourself, the things that you give up to try to make it. Like he has to join a band that's not necessarily his thing. Like I did on second watch appreciate the fact that when he's playing at the party and she kind of, she makes him play the song. I don't remember what the song is. Iran. And he's like hitting the keys all sarcastically and chastises her for making him play it. The mirror of that to when she sees him in the band performing and he's on the keys and he's having what looks to be like a legitimately good time on stage, but he's essentially playing Iran.
Right.
But enjoying it. And so between that, like, nadir, in quotes, for him and her putting all this time and effort into a one-woman show and it causing debt, you're seeing these more relatable sacrifices that are then embodied in the fact that they have to give up each other in order to pursue the things that they want to pursue and just that missed what if that they have. So yeah, that's, I mean, that's supposed to be the thing. Like you go to Hollywood, you try to make it and it's a struggle and sometimes there's a sacrifice that hurts, but you get what you hoped for through that sacrifice.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, not that the movie has to be dark or anything, although like there's plenty of dark moments and the ending isn't exactly like a feel-good ending. It ends in melancholy in a way. I just can't help but compare it to something like Mulholland Drive, where like, even though the whole movie, you're not really sure what it's doing because you don't know the whole movie's a dream sequence. Once you figure out it is a dream sequence, you're able to view everything differently. And the ending, the whole post-dream sequence where we see that Diane has done something terrible and hired a hitman to kill Rita. I guess spoilers from Mulholland Drive. like all of that, it really helps you understand everything. It brings light to the whole movie. It helps you put the pieces together and understand what certain scenes are about and see the narrative and thematic thrust of the movie. And it allows the ending, the darkness, the tragedy of that ending to really hit. Like, I'm just kidding, you're comparing Mulholland Drive's ending to La La Land's. And again, not that La La Land needs to be super, super sad and tragic, but I guess I don't feel much of anything. Like, I don't feel like the whim. I don't feel like the promise of a better future. I mean, you're right to note that we know nothing about their places in their career at this point. Not that I think the movie needs to get into a bunch of inane details and explain where they're at, but like the end of the movie could stylistically in an interesting way explore all these things and show us all these things, kind of like it did with the what if sequence. Like, there are plenty of ways the movie could have gone about it to breed everything together. And
yeah,
it's just, you know, it's not there.
It's completely unwieldy. You spend the first hour of the movie is them getting together. They're not even together. It's just like that much time is spent on establishing what they're doing individually, like the flirtation, the initial steps. And then finally it's an hour in that they're together and we go to summer or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the whole time that they're together to her getting the audition, I think is 43 minutes or like 40 minutes. It's the 5 years later starts at an hour 43.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie goes until 2 hours and 7 minutes. So you're like, oh, that's a decent chunk, right? Except the credits are long, meaning that in total, there's only like 17 minutes for the last part of the movie.
Yeah.
And in that time, I think it's like 7 to 9 minutes are the actual flashback sequence or the what if sequence. So you only have like 8 minutes of the movie to establish where they're at in their lives and explore that when the entire point of the movie was to get there. So we see her go in and get coffee, and it brings us full circle because she was the girl that was the barista when the famous actress came in to get coffee. And it's like, that's cool, but does that matter? Like, what? Yeah. What's the energy of that? What's the tone of that? What's the point of that? And then the what if being so long. You said it did nothing for you. It does nothing for me either. And I'm like, I'm crying on the second watch. I'm just randomly crying at parts throughout the movie where they're interacting because I know what's going to happen. I know how much they care about each other. I'm a sap in general. I'm always vicariously feeling what other characters are feeling and cry easily. That last flash sideways does absolutely nothing for me because what's the point? Like, we know that they could be together. I don't need to see what it would have been like. Cool. That's exactly what I pictured. I need to know more about where they're at and why and what that means to them to make the story really feel satisfying at the end and not feel like just this tacked on thing.
Mm. Yeah. Yep. Totally agree. And I agree with all that, but I think on a deeper level, what frustrates me the most is what I've said several times is just the technical aspects of the movie and how, you know, that whole last scene we're watching Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling dance together. They're great. I guess this is a testament to how shitty the technical aspects of the movie are, that they're so good together. Yet, like, when they're dancing together, like, it's kind of an eye roll for me. Like, think about their introduction and the closing of their relationship. Like, the introduction is them on that hill overlooking the city, and it's just them two dancing together. That scene should be immaculate. That should, like, pull me in. That should make me, like, fall in love with these people. But, like, nothing against them, but, like, they aren't great dancers, and they're not necessarily great singers by nature. So, like, and on top of that, you know, the whole opening sequence, which is full of people who professionally dance, like, already feels awkwardly staged and choreographed, in my opinion. So, like, I don't expect much better for these two. Like, it's kind of awkward to watch it, and there's nothing, like, fascinating about it. I kind of just feel like I'm watching two people go through the motions of a dance they learned the day before after a few sessions. And that's how I feel at the end, too. Like, the way everything's, like, filmed and choreographed, and the way the camera's, like, moving us in and out of scenes, like, seamlessly, like, it just feels all forced to me, and it's not giving off the feeling it should, which is, you know, I think about Barbie. Ryan Gosling is amazing in Barbie. Like, I love when he sings and dances. Like, there's such energy, there's such chemistry between him and everybody else, and it's conveying a lot of what the movie's exploring thematically. It's, I don't know, it's just, like, all that stuff is, to me, why the ending really doesn't work. Everything you said, Chris, like, of course, you're totally right about all that. Like, the math just doesn't check out. But the art, you know, the colors, the prettiness, like, I need all that stuff. I need that stuff to work for me to care. That's what makes me care. And it's not there.
Yeah. I mean, there's still that distance. Like, as you said, when they're dancing together on that hill, it's a pretty picture, but it's still, like, a distance from what's happening. And there's a part of me that appreciates that, because I know that they're actually dancing and they're doing it in one take, and again, the technical aspect of that I like and respect. But there is just something that's also a little more okay. Which I will say, this won't surprise you, but it might annoy you. There's a big long shot at the beginning of Babylon. And okay. Just comparing the energy between that and La La Land is so night and day. The Babylon scene is completely bonkers to me. Like, I don't know how they possibly filmed it. It's just such chaos and madness. And it's the one thing that I keep thinking about nonstop ever since I saw the movie, was that opening sequence.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I, for the record, I don't mind one take scenes.
But yeah. It's just the distance in La La Land is something that almost robs it of some of its power and emotion. And plus, you know, it's supposed to be this intimate romantic moment between them, and yet the how it's filmed creates that sense of distance that's not necessarily bringing us into the emotions of that moment.
Yeah. Yeah, so, gosh. I mean, I don't know what else to say. I feel like I got out everything I wanted to complain about. Barbie, it's the thing that I've thought about most, though. Just, like, thinking about Ryan Gosling and Barbie and how well he does. You know, it's not even that I need someone to be a good singer or dancer. Like, I'm thinking about Mamma Mia and how, like, Pierce Brosnan, that dude can't sing to save his life. Like, it's almost, I would go as far to say it's embarrassing, but it totally works in that movie. Like, the way who his character is, his kind of, like, his dejectedness, just the fact that he kind of is, like, this normal guy who is on the outside of Meryl Streep's life and kind of is sucked into this crazy world she's in. That him, Colin Firth, Stellan Skarsgård, like, you don't really need them to be incredible dancers. Like, it's kind of fun to watch, like, this old guy who can't dance, like, trying to keep up with all these young people. That's not really the case in something like La La Land. Like, it really does purport that all these people can do all of these things and you're supposed to be sucked in. And it's, I don't know. Yeah. That was just a bummer for me to watch Ryan Gosling doing that.
Damn.
I love you, Ryan Gosling. If you're listening, I love you.
So ranking?
Yeah. We got to rank Drive as well.
Yeah. I'm looking right now where I'm going to put Drive.
Okay. So I'll start with Drive. Anybody who listened to last episode knows I love Drive. I've loved it since the day it came out. It's been a movie I watched several times. My wife and I covered this movie. Of the 424 movies on my rankings, and this is movies we've watched since the start of 2022, mine Drive for me is at 26.
Whoa, that's very high. Is that the highest of any that we've talked about on the show so far?
I would think so. Well, you know, we talked about the Fast movies, and the Fast and the Furious is at 19, and Fast 5 is at 20. So
that's true. That is true.
And Chungking Express is at number 8.
Yeah. Okay. So we've done some of the highlights on yours.
Yeah.
I think I have Drive right now at number 33.
Out of
152.
All right. Top third. I like it.
Yeah. I have it in the impressive category. So it's in the near the top. I was just trying to think of another way to phrase that and ran out of brain juice. And then La La Land is lower.
Yeah. Out of 424, it's at 396 for me. It's in the categories of movie where, like, it's even, because I have a category that's just, like, not for me. Like, I could recognize that, you know, there are things about it that work really well and that it just is not something that appeals to me. I find very little in La La Land that works. And I think it's a movie that just fundamentally is not sound. So it's just in this kind of bottom bad category.
Yeah, I call that really not for me. Really? So it's really not for me and then not for me.
That's probably what I should call this section.
It seemed like the nicest way of phrasing it. But also giving off how strongly I feel about the movies down there.
Yeah.
I have La La Land at number 115. It's at the top of the almost category. So neutral is the middle ground of the 10 categories. So it's the top one of the the one just below neutral. Yeah, there's some decent ones in there. No, they're not. Like, it's above Scream 3. I don't think people usually think of those movies as being
right. I would put Scream 3 above this.
It's just below Koi and Iskatsi.
I don't even know what that is.
It's one of the weirdest movies I've ever seen. It's more of like a, like, moving pictures. I don't know. It's just shots of various things and people doing things. So it's very meditative, but starts to look at essentially technology and humanity and the way in which, like, human civilization is starting to get more maybe, like, distant, disconnected due to technology.
Okay.
But you have, like, 7-minute sequences of just showing, like, highways.
Sounds fascinating.
Or like 8 minutes of just showing people in like a factory boxing bread.
And this is better or worse than La La Land?
Better.
There you go, Damien Chazelle. That's the ceiling for you.
Oh my god. Well, okay.
Maybe we should cover Whiplash so one of us will actually defend Damien Chazelle.
I mean, if we do Babylon, I'll defend.
I still gotta watch it. Who knows, I might like it, but the track record has not been great.
Get into it, Travis.
By the way I refuse, I don't care if it becomes the number one article on our site, I would refuse to watch First Man.
I
don't think a movie's ever looked less interesting than me.
Yeah, neither of us have seen it, have we?
I would never. unless I was forced to for this podcast.
I kind of want to now, just to see.
You should write it and like turn the movie into a classic, all in a plight to make me watch it.
Yeah, this is what I'm going to dedicate the rest of my career to. Getting people to rally around First Man as the movie of the 21st century.
Good luck.
Thank you. I'll need it. This is, as they say, a moonshot.
Hmm. Okay.
Too cheesy.
What's the next movie?
I mean, it could be... it could be Babylon.
Is Babylon actually doing that well?
I mean, it's in the top 50 right now.
Top 50. There's a lot of movies in the top 50.
It would be... above La La Land right now.
I guess it would be a very poetic thing to do.
Yeah.
I would do it.
All right. Let's do Babylon.
All right. This will be interesting. Damien Chazelle either is going to really... He's really not going to like us by the end of this, I would imagine.
We go to Sundance and he's there and he walks up to us and he either punches us in the face... And I like to picture it as him walking up and doing, like, we're standing side by side, and he makes, like, two fists and just double punches. Like, he's Batman in the 1960 TV show. Right? Just punches us simultaneously in the face, or walks up and says, I need to shake your hand because you said some real things that I needed to hear.
If he did that, I would watch First Man. that's the one way I'll watch it.
He's like, watch First Man with me and let me know.
I would. I'd hold his hand the whole time.
That's if he ever listens to this.
Yeah, that's my promise to you if you're listening.
I'll just immediately ask for his forgiveness and then run out of the room.
Okay, so we're wrapping up here. We got to wrap up the set, right, guys?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so are we ready, everybody? Okay. Lights.
Camera.
See ya.
We'll get better at it.